Welcome to TA1. Everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and then some, and again, a then some episode. Talking to Daniel Evans, the race boss for the Race to Alaska boat race. Totally unpowered 750-mile race from Washington to Alaska with basically no rules. So this is Daniel's second appearance on the podcast, and I gotta say it, after 5 years, his first episode was the most listened to one. He beat out Nathan, what can I say? So we'll see how this one goes. We will be talking to some of the racers that will be doing the R2AK for the next few weeks, just because I think they're a bunch of really crazies and very interesting to talk to. So, we'll have a few episodes of that. And a few other water episodes coming up, because we all know how much I love the water. So, anyway, not much new going on here. Let's see, leaving in about 10 days to get the van. So pretty excited about that, as well as Paulette and my mother. My 83-year-old mother decided that she needed a transit sportsmobile van to go traveling in. So more power to her. So, all right, let's get this show on the road. So remember, slow is fast, fast is good, and watch out for ocean-going vessels. Thanks for listening. Bye.
If I join with audio, that helps.
Aha! There it is.
I always test my audio, and then I forget to join.
Wait, are we doing the podcast right now? I thought we were talking about the whole thing.
No, we're doing the podcast.
Oh, wow. Well, we'll see about this. I am unprepared and sick, so this will be great.
Well, do you want to do it another time? I'm fine. We have no schedule.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so.
I mean, maybe a little time. You know, it's, it depends what we're going to talk about. We're talking about this year and a lot of the new teams. I know some of them, but I don't have all of them on the tip of my tongue. You know what I mean? And there are some crazy teams. What do you want to talk about?
Well, the race and just generally what it is and where it came from and all the crazies. But you know, I would like your opinion on some of the teams. So if you want to research a little more, that's cool too. I'm good either way.
No, let's do it. Okay. Let's go. Yeah, why not?
That's the attitude. That's the can-do spirit.
It's like, go forward, worry about it later. There it is. Yeah, how you been?
I've been good, been busy. Lots of new things going on. So it's an exciting year for me.
Yeah?
I've got a new gig with a sports car team doing their media.
Oh, really?
So I'm traveling. I'll be traveling like 20 weeks a year to do all their – we'll be doing live in-car camera stuff, live stream, and all their social media and that kind of stuff. So,
that's great. That's great.
I'm pretty excited. Although I keep telling people after 20 weekends of travel, I'm wondering how exciting I'll be about going again.
I know. I mean, I'm not great on math or anything. That's over a third of the year out and about.
Yep. Yeah. So. We've postponed a couple of races. So it's a very interesting concept. So they're a race team, but they rent seats. So it's like a low budget endurance racing. So each weekend is an eight hour race and a 7 hour race. So Flying Ghost, I'm representing the.
Oh yeah.
They rent seats out. So if you're a driver, you want to be a race car driver, you rent a seat. You don't have to buy a car. You don't have to do all that. They come in, they're treated like professional drivers and get get 4, 5, 6 hours of racing in a weekend. And it's really cool. So, but yeah, starting in April, basically every 2 weeks, and if not more than that through November, I'll be traveling.
Have you ever heard of the Shitbox Rally?
Yeah.
That's a
very interesting, it's almost the same concept with basically a low budget car.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're like $500. Is that the Shitbox Rally or something like that?
Something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And amateur enthusiasts who want to do something pretty spectacular. It's a lot like, I know about it, cause I feel like it's a lot like Race to Alaska. I mean, we're a Shitbox Rally on the water. I mean, some people bring, we don't put a limit to what you bring, but there's no like bottom limit either. So yeah it's a lot the same way.
Yeah. The Champ Car Series is the same way. They're basically stripped down street cars turned into race cars, but they have a point system. So if you put a new motor in, it's 100 points and you get 500 points. So you can do whatever you want, but only so much.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's a smart way to look at it. Yeah, totally.
So do you ever expect somebody to show up in a 90-foot sailboat to do this race, to do your race?
I mean, I have been begging for someone to try and do this in a 90-foot race or sailboat. We had there's a team named Tritium one year. This is back 2018. And they were coming up in, it was a 70-foot trimaran. And they still hadn't figured out, and we had no way of knowing, how they would even fit in the finish line at Thomas Basin and Ketchikan, or how they could get in and out of Ketchikan or in and out of Victoria without some sort of help. But they, fortunately for I think all of us, the boat broke as it was sailing up here from California, and they picked up a smaller, very fast boat to do the race in instead. Yeah.
So I suppose we should. Okay, here's my burning question: is it R2AK or R2AK?
Wait, I didn't notice a difference.
Is it R2AK or R2AK?
I would let's see. How would I say it? Welcome to R2AK.
Okay. So I hear the difference, but I'm so weird. It's like, well, I wonder how you're supposed to say it.
Yeah, I'm Alaskan, so we don't really deal with those types of nuances. We just kind of moose our way past them.
That's a good way to do it. And who are you?
My name is Daniel Evans, and I am the race boss for the Race to Alaska.
And one of the founders.
Yeah, I'm a co-founder of the Race to Alaska. You know, the quick way of saying it is so I'm part of the nonprofit, which is the Northwest Maritime Center in Port Townsend. And Jake Beatty, who's the executive director, many years ago, had this conversation with a few people about like a desire to reclaim the water in a lot of ways. The water was feeling like it was more exclusive. All the races had a bunch of rules. All the boats were expensive, the skill sets. There wasn't a lot of attraction for kind of the everyday person. Mm-hmm. And the question was posed like, you know, what could be done to make that more exciting? And the typical answers came out. And I'm not like besmirching these people, because I've had these typical answers too at different times. But it was like, oh, let's do, you know, a round Maristone Island race or some other little regatta thing or some other little small boat thing. And Jake wisely was like, what a bunch of crap. It's been done and done and done. And he was sitting at the Wooden Boat Festival and kind of, he's been to Alaska plenty, kind of looked his way north and was like, we should race to Alaska. And they're all like, that's the stupidest idea ever. And they laughed it off. But he walked away from that conversation kind of chewing on that. A number of months later, he was still chewing on it and actually starting to generate some ideas around it and some concepts, starting to get a website going. And he ran into me on the street. I was driving like big schooners. I was a captain. So, you know, driving boats all over the place, and old friend, we're old friends. And he's like, you know about this idea, Race to Alaska? I'm like, yeah, yeah. It's like the best, worst idea I've ever heard of. And he's like, you know, I think you should come and make it happen with me. And I was like, done. And the next day I hired on and started putting that kind of dream into a reality.
Yeah. Just that, always say yes and then deal with consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly it. And I think there, yeah, it's even a little bit more than that. It's that always say yes, knowing that yes is out there. It's just, what do you have to do to get to it? And it's like, it's a lot like the race. It's just like, yeah, there's a ton of obstacles that seem super improbable, but just start with a yes and then make the two ends meet.
Very cool. So yeah. Just describe the race.
Yeah, the Race to Alaska is, and it has very few rules. It is, the rules are essentially you can't have an engine at all. It's a boat race from Port Townsend to Washington to Ketchikan, Alaska. You get a boat. There is a kind of a, though it doesn't look like it, there is a vetting. So we kind of look at the boats and the racers and make sure that some combination of that gives us some level of confidence that they will make the right choice, whatever that is going up there. Get a boat without an engine, not even like, no, you can't just pull the propeller, just no engine. Agree to go on the race unsupported, which means no food drops, no, you know, having your grandpappy wait for you at some dock to give you advice. And no, you know, no cell phone in your back pocket with some expert telling you what to do, and get ready to race. We fire a gun in Port Townsend. They take off to Victoria. They have 36 hours to get to Victoria, roughly 40 miles. It's called the Proving Ground, stage one. If they can make it those first 40 miles in 36 hours, they get to go on. If they can't, they're done. They're just packing it in. Yeah. We do a second start out of Victoria after a couple of days, a little bit of parties. And then everyone goes. And essentially, if they make it to Victoria, or if they make it to Ketchikan, we are there to give them the pat on the back they deserve, because it's incredible. Roughly 50% finish nowadays.
Yeah. And it's one of the most unique prize lists in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, first place is $10,000, which, you know, it can mean a lot in the right circumstance, but if you're going to spend like 2 weeks and a boat and all this time off to get there, it's probably not that much. Yeah. Second place is a well-awarded set of steak knives, kind of mid-range, but they do have our logo on it. And, yeah. You know, third place and beyond is just huge congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we, all right. We'll keep talking, but I have to turn the oven off. So in the spirit of R2AK, my anniversary is next week. I'm the 14th, and my wife is in Washington.
Huh?
So, and you know what March 14th is, do you? Do you know that?
The Ides of March?
No, that's the 17th.
No, it's the 15th. 15th.
15th, yes. The 14th is
the day before the Ides of March.
3.14. It's Pi Day.
Yes, Pi Day.
So we could never remember our anniversary exactly until Pi Day became such a big deal on the internet. So I was baking a pie, so I'll do a little video of eating pie for the next few days to send to her for our anniversary.
Oh, that's sweet.
Oh. Yeah. Plus I get to eat pie.
Yeah, right.
So this is a real race though. I mean, right to me, I mean, it looked like a real race. I was looking at the safety gear and that stuff. And you're serious about safety.
Yeah. Yeah. We're really serious about safety. I mean, it's it's an unsupported race, but it's not unsupervised. And me and I have an operations person that works with me, Jesse, and a whole team of like safety volunteers that have a lot of credentials, as well as we do a lot of work with the local search and rescue agencies throughout the course. So there's this whole framework of safeties and check-ins, and you know, the all the racers carry trackers. You know, we use spot trackers, but so we watch them 24 hours a day, though everyone can, it's online for free. And so we're definitely checking in on everyone, making sure, because it's, you know, it's, we joke a lot about it, but it's kind of like when you're full of fear, you sometimes make jokes, and that's like this race the entire time, because it's huge water. It's, you know, 15 knot currents, it's giant eddies. It's extremely remote. Once you get north, you know, you're 60 miles away from the nearest settlement at any given time. And you go through patches where there is nothing that is holding the water back between you and Hawaii. So any big Pacific storm that's out there is rolling in, bashing into these other currents, bashing into the islands, bouncing back. And it's just, you know, you all in your boat to figure it out. It's a huge undertaking.
It is. Do you need permits for a race like this?
You need, with the U.S. Coast Guard, you need permits. And while we don't necessarily need a permit from the Canadian Coast Guard, we get their approval. I mean, we do all our work with them ahead of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was their reaction the first time?
Well, the first time was the best reaction possible, which was the U.S. Coast Guard actually found out a way that they could create a law, an actual law in the books for Race to Alaska, which prohibited the boats from sailing into a certain area during the race. And they seemed very happy when they called me to tell me that they had created this law. I was happy that I just created enough trouble to require a law. And the only time they've ever tried, and it meant that they could, if any race team got in that body of water, that area of water, they could go in with Coast Guard and they could find them and potentially imprison them. And the only time it ever was put into play, I get a call on the stage one, that proving ground, and they say, there's a boat there, we're going to get them. And I'm looking at all my trackers, I'm talking to my observation boats, I don't see anything. And I was like, well, I have no idea who that is. And they're like, this is it, we're going to bust them, it's going down, we told you to stay out of that area. And they pull up and it's just some recreational boater that's just heading from north to south, and it wasn't even our team. Yeah, so they let them go.
So what were they trying to, was there a legitimate reason for they wanted to keep them out, or were they trying to stop the race?
Well, no, it wasn't. It was, so in the body of water around here, there's a thing called vessel traffic service, and there's a thing called the traffic separation lanes in the water. And that's not all around the United States, but it's on the West Coast and a little bit on the East. But essentially it's like a road on the water that is given preference to shipping traffic. And they have big turning areas when they have to change direction. And those are called precautionary areas. And they wanted them out of this one main precautionary area that's a feeder into Puget Sound. But the truth was that once we told people, like, yo, this is a bad place to be, you may not know this because you're not from around here, stay away, everyone has avoided it ever since.
So yeah, a win-win for you. What's the ratio of locals to people coming from other places?
Yeah, it's the teams, they do come from all over, which is crazy. The first year that Jake and I were putting this on, we thought like four teams would show up. We even had this joke that he had a really big pot, so he was going to make some chili for everyone before the race, the day before, because we started at 5 a.m. on the day of, and like 44 teams showed up. And what we found over the last few years is that We get, of course, a lot of teams in the U.S., but they'll come from all over the U.S. We'll get a lot of teams from Canada, mostly the western side of Canada, but some on the eastern. And then about 20 to 30% of the teams are international. So they're coming from, I mean, Australia, of course, they're always showing up. But Australia, France, Poland, Germany, England. And recently there's been some hints that some people in China want to come do the race. I was like, fantastic. That's great.
So how do they get boats? Do they sail? Do they,
yeah. Yeah. You know, there's a guy from Australia. He's signed up and is trying to sail here. But, you know, from Australia, to do it smartly, it takes 2 years because of all the weather patterns. And so I don't know when I'm going to see him, but there are a lot of teams. There was one team out of France, Team Lightboat, who he built his boat, shipped it here. It was small enough. It was a 20-foot boat and reassembled it and sailed it. Other teams just buy them off of Craigslist, or there's a really good there's a really good kind of tribe of people now around this, like happens in a lot of races. And so if I get someone who says, I want to do this race, I need to figure out how to do it, I know who to send them to like start the wheels turning. They usually like borrow a boat, beg a boat, buy a boat, something along those lines.
Yeah. So what year are we in now for 22?
Well, we have to exclude the 2 years that we couldn't do it because they shut the border to Canada due to COVID. And so this is year six, though we started in 2015. Yeah. And I mean, everyone's rearing to go. It's amazing. Yeah. There, we have, like as of January, we had twice as many applicants as we've ever had before. And right now I think we're at 47 teams and we still have another month to go before the application deadline. And that's usually we're at about 44 teams. So it's, and we just had like another one today apply. So people are rearing to go.
Do you have a vetting policy for them, or you just, you show up, you get to race?
No. A vetting policy would be strong, Randy. I would say that.
I understand that, but yeah.
Yeah, but I have a top secret vetting team that we run all the applicants through. So you have to apply and you have to get approved. Commonly, the things that will get you denied, like come back with this more later, is if you, for instance, built your boat out of the back of some Popular Mechanics ad, or you're a mad scientist that thinks some gizmo where you hop up and down is the right way to go. Or if you have all of the enthusiasm, but not enough experience, like being able to tell what colored lights are on the water and what they mean. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's we call it an adventure resume though, because we recognize that it's like, you don't have to be some super boater to do the race, mountaineering, you know, marathoning, being in the woods in general, even hunting, driving cars really fast. Those all play into that same level of decision-making. And that's what we're looking for, is a level of appropriate decision-making coupled with some idea of how to sail to Alaska and what that really means, the waters, the currents, et cetera. And then finally, it's having a boat that's not a shitbox, a total shitbox. Yeah.
Do so is it knowledge or physical material that screws up most people? Is it the boat or is it their lack of experience?
Yeah, that's somebody really applied. I feel like I've been studying failure a lot over these years because it's as predominant as success in some ways, at least for getting to the finish line. And what I come to believe, it's almost like religion, but I feel like the water, this area between here and Ketchikan, has an ability to exploit whatever weakness you forgot to think about. And it just needles in there and then it just rips your whole plan apart. And it could be that you didn't really test your boat well enough or fix enough things ahead of time. And your boat, you know, we've had boats delaminate, just the bows have just literally started to peel away from the center of the boat. We've had dismastings, we've had boats roll over, we've had them just fill with water and never fill out again. And but and we've had the other one, which is like the mental thing. I'd say far too many people have been like, wow, I hallucinated during that time. But I can remember one guy in particular that swore to me he was being chased by ghosts during part of the race. But an interesting one is that one of the team that has the record of it's like 3 days, 20 hours and 12 seconds, which I've done that route a lot, even in powerboats, and I don't go that fast. It was insane. And they had everything planned out. They're on this really go fast. It was like it was a catamaran with a trampoline in between it, you know, kind of like a Hobie Cat. But it was a Marstrom 32, much faster, more expensive, but they had everything planned out, different routes, what if the weather happened, if they hit here and the weather's like here, they go that way. If their timing's like this, at this tidal cycle, everything. It was irritating. I would never do that myself. It was way too much information. But the thing they didn't think about, the boat, when it sails, one side of it's always in the air, right? In these catamarans, one side's always in the air. And they had this thing like a body bag that there was three people in the crew, and the third person who was not, you know, working at the time or on watch would climb into that zip up and get some sleep. Well, they thought of everything except that they went so darn fast that they had to tack, or they had to pick one side up, drop it down and the other side up and flop the sails over every 20 minutes for most of the race. So the person who was trying to sleep never got sleep. And by day two, they had stopped eating. By day three, they had stopped drinking water, and the fatigue and the hallucination, and they had stopped sleeping well before that. And they said when they hit Ketchikan that if it was any longer at all, they would have just started running into islands. And so it exploited just that thing. So it always finds a very unique weakness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? So I'm a land lover. I think we might have talked about that before. What is the why? I guess it's the simplest reason.
Yeah.
It's not easy. Yeah. You can die. I mean, is that it? It's because it's not easy, or is it? They feel that way about the sea.
You know, it's somewhat like that. You know, it's interesting. You know, just recently they discovered the Endurance in the Weddell Sea, which was Shackleton's ship when he in his failed plight, but turned into, you know, the best adventure story of all time. You know, 2 years on the ice, essentially. And I draw a parallel a lot to that, because when he was getting ready for that expedition, he put this ad out that essentially said, I'm looking for sailors. It's going to suck. It's going to be risky. There's even a line of like safe return doubtful, fame and recognition, and, you know, if we return. And he put that ad out in the London Times. And when, you know, as the story goes, when he opened his doors to accept crew, the line was around the block. People responded to that. And for me, I think, why we all do this, me and Jesse and Jake and everyone who helps out, there's this belief that there's this call, there's this little piece of our heart that is just waiting to be called. Because as we continue to do the smart thing to survive, which is surround ourselves with, you know, automatic heat and cars with airbags and cell phones for communication, we no longer challenge ourselves the way we used to. But there's this part in our heart that's just waiting for that, for the call to challenge. And and when it hears it, I think it's like, me, choose me. Because it gives us that opportunity to be more than we have ever thought we were able to be. And so I think people really do it, you know, people don't do it for first place. There's a few of them that do, of course, but most of them are doing it because they're responding to that call. You know, they're taking long enough to take the logical part of their brain, slam it down on the floor till it's a little bit quiet, and let that primal part kind of rear up and take charge for a little while.
Yeah, I obviously don't have that. Maybe tiny little bit, but I understand what you're saying. And yeah, more power to him. Yeah, I would have never gone with Shackleton. So would you have?
Yeah, I would have gone with Shackleton. Yeah, that was, I mean, what an awesome trip. Yeah, let's go discover a country. Maybe we'll make it, maybe we'll not. I mean, yeah, sadly, that's my MO.
Probably in my introduction, if I don't do it now, but I might tell people to go back and listen to our other episode, because we get into a lot of that stuff, which was fascinating.
Yeah.
I think I told you, your first episode was my most listened to episode. So there you go. Kudos to you. But that all said, and people have this calling, does anybody ever show up, do the proving ground, and say, you know what, that was enough, even though they had planned to do the whole race?
Every year there are some that don't do the, that don't finish the proving ground, and they realize it's enough. And there are, so as you leave Victoria and you start heading north, it's really kind of perfect. Everything slowly starts dropping off. Your ability to communicate, the towns, the ability to find repair gear, safe harbors, everything gets less and less and less. So there's this town right before Seymour Narrows, and that's one of our waypoints typically. This year we've removed it as a waypoint, but everyone would come into Seymour Narrows to Campbell River, the town there. And that was a place of real reckoning, because after that, it got wild, wild west really quick.
Yeah.
And the currents are bigger. Johnstone Strait had these waves that, like, every one of them looked like it was designed to hate you. It's amazing how gnarly it gets. Current against waves, they stand up. They're I call them anvil-headed. And a lot of people between Victoria and Campbell River is where they drop out. And a couple of people have stood at Campbell River and said, I could go on, I'm not gonna go on. Oh, and one team had a full mutiny at Campbell River. Everyone except the captain, they're like, we're done and we're walking.
So, well, it sounds like it, if you have any doubts, that's the correct course of action, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the stop. Yeah. So I was looking at it where with your, how do you put it? We made it simpler, but harder. So you have one waypoint for the whole race, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We used to have two and we got rid of one of them. And
why?
To kind of got rid of it to, well, cause it's fun and irritating, which is a main reason why we change a lot of things, but it was to kind of widen the riddle by getting rid of the Seymour Narrows waypoint. It allowed some teams properly equipped to make the choice to actually, for the first part of the race, to go outside Vancouver Island and into the Pacific Ocean, thinking maybe that might offer them some strategy. Now, you know, kayaks aren't going to do it. Stand-up paddleboards aren't going to do it. But we have about 15% of the teams, 20% of the teams are preparing for that possibility. And then they'll all have to come back into the inside passage to Bella Bella and then head up to Ketchikan. The fun part that I'm really looking forward to is they actually don't have to decide. I mean, they just have, if they equip for it, that's fine. They don't have to decide till they leave Victoria. And they don't even have to tell us. I'm calling it the great left or right. But to sit out there, and as they all leave Victoria, they're going to choose to go one direction and go up Vancouver Island, or the other direction and up the inside passage. And I can't wait to see how that works out.
Which is that, I mean, is that like weather dependent, or, you know, just the conditions, or do you have to get there to decide? You can't decide today which one you're going to do.
You can't at all decide today. The weather can be anything it wants to be, for sure. And the outside of Vancouver Island has like no places to hide. there's nothing out there. So, and it's, you know, Vancouver Island's 300 miles long and you have to get around the bottom of it, go up and go around the top to get into Bella Bella. So it's, the exposure is huge. So it's something that you have to decide then, because that weather can make it a sleigh ride downwind. You're going really well, or it could be a dead calm out there. You know, you could go out, that's a risk. You go out there and in 2 days it's dead calm. And to be on the Pacific with no motor, maybe some oars, in a dead calm is not something I would want to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they have access to the weather, it forecasts and stuff like that. Yeah. How accurate can it be in that area?
You know, it's a good question. It's a big joke about Weather Canada, how accurate they are. They tend, the more remote it gets, the more inaccurate it gets. Yeah. It's not so bad in that Southern Vancouver area. I'm going to give it like it's 70% correct around there, and then it drops off pretty rapidly. Yeah. I think you have to be pretty good at predicting your own weather, like looking at the weather patterns, you know, wind directions, barometric pressure, cloud formations, and then maybe you can start figuring out some of it for yourself, but it's going to be a bit of a gamble no matter what.
Yeah. Can you even sort of guess what people will do, or you just got to wait and see?
Yeah, I really have, like, every person who's put in for going around the outside and adding the additional safety equipment is entirely non-committal, which I love. And they just get to choose one or the other, and the race is on either way.
Yeah. who's been your favorite team in the history of the race?
Oh, what a tough question. What a tough question.
I know. Who's your favorite kid? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean,
all right, you can have a few. Who are a few of your favorite teams?
A few of my favorite teams. There was, there was Team Sistership, which was an all-female team, raced for 2 years. They were both raising money for women's programming, but also they were all over 50, and that was part of their thing. They're like loud and proud. Over 50 is not a time to go lay down, sit on the couch, and worry about your knees. There's a ton out there for you to do, and we're doing it, which was amazing. They even had one of the crew members had like stage 4 cancer. And when she did the first leg of the race, the proving ground, and she passed away shortly after, but not until she said that was one of the favorite things she did in her adult life. It like made a difference. And so I was really glad that the race was able to add cause to itself without me having to do anything. But just adding the platform, there's a guy named Carl Kruger, and he was on a stand-up paddleboard, and he did it. I know, which you're like, how is that even? I mean, how could anyone even like kayak? Because lots of people did it through time, right? The Haida and the Tlingit and a lot of other local tribes were up and down the waterway all the time, but not in a race format where they had to move. Yeah. So Carl came out in 2017 and broke his board. It just broke. It just filled with water and it broke. He spent an entire year refining everything. He got a board hand-built, custom-built by Joe Bark. And he completed the race on a stand-up paddleboard, totally self-sufficient. And he did it in about 16 days, which is insane. But I think the thing I like most about it is that he allowed me to create what I call the stand-up paddleboard wall of shame, which were all the sailboats he beat. There was like 12 boats that, and some of them really fast boats that he out paddled. But he created this one moment. There was a storm, and this was just north of Campbell River, where, again, like it gets kind of wild and woolly out there. He was on an island. There was a storm coming that we all knew about. I was up in Campbell River. I was on a boat. I was doing media and monitoring everything with the rest of us. And I looked on the tracker, and all the race teams were kind of tucked in. Everyone knew it was coming. It was going to blow 50 knots, which is like, what is that, like 50, 60 miles an hour right up in there. And They're all tucked in, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I had this odd hunch, and I turned on the tracker, and I just started staring at his little blip, and he was on this little island, and at about 11:30 at night, that little blip started moving, and it moved right out into the middle of the channel when it was blowing 40 plus knots. And I talked to him later, and I was like, what were you doing out there? And he said, well, you know, I was surfing. And he got on a stand-up paddleboard loaded with all his gear in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere. And he just started paddling and surfing these enormous waves because the wind was behind him. And he made, I can't even remember, like 100 miles in that go. It was incredible. So what I love, he's just amazing. He is an adventurer, and he always has been. And he's not covered with endorsements or anything else. You know, he lives on Orcas Island. He does a sailboat charter. He's doing more now, but he was just going out there because he had some part of himself that he needed to reconnect to, and he found a way to do it. So he's definitely one of my favorites.
I almost want to say, you must be lying about that. That didn't really happen.
I wish. Randy, you wouldn't believe how many stories that are total lies that are not lies, but sound like it. That's what I meant to say.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, yeah, it happens everywhere. I mean, the whole history of expedition, it's sounds like fiction.
Yeah.
Shackleton sounds like fiction, right?
Yeah. I think all of the greatest stories are founded on improbability turned probable. There was a team that they were in again, like a Hobie Cat. It was called Team Mao in 2015, first year. They were in this like 20-foot catamaran with a little trapeze between it. So no deck, no structure at all. And they were caught in a storm. They were waiting 2 days. The storm kept going. So the storm had been going for 48 hours, and it was blowing 30 knots, enough to blow trees down. And they thought there was a lull. They went out immediately, boom, the boat turtled. So it just flipped over, so the mast upside down. They're in their dry suits next to it going, oh my God, now what? And they notice the wind is blowing them towards this huge rock outcropping with frothing seas around it, like death and destruction all around this rock. And they're trying to figure out what to do, and they're getting rushed towards this rock. And what happens is their mast, which is, goes 30 feet underwater, ran aground first against some rock underwater, enough to flip the boat back over right in front of the rocks. They look up, the mast looks fine. They climb aboard, they set the sail, and they take off, and they finish the race. I mean, it was incredible. Yeah.
I don't know if we talked about this before, but Is that one of those situations like that where when you're on the water, does time slow down? That's what, how people describe it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, time slows right down. Yeah, everything gets, and your focus comes down to just this like slow moving pinpoint. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, very interesting. So you got a favorite team or two for this year that you're pretty excited about?
I mean, this year
or scared about?
Yeah, it's a combination for sure. You know, it's so every year we get a variety of boats, and every year now, especially the last few years, we have human powered boats, boats that have decided they're going to do it all under oar or paddle. There's a team Oracle. They've raced every year. They finished all but one, and they're coming back out. And they're like a love story. They first raced on different boats, and they were sailing. They met because of the race, and then fell in love. And she's an Olympic rower, and he took up rowing because she's smarter than he is and talked him into it. And they've done it in a sliding seat and a kayak, and they're coming back out again. It's this Ian and Janice. They're wonderful. And so there's some returning people that it's like a family reunion, which is really nice. Yeah. But then on the flip side, there are the next generation. And I'd say what I'm most excited about is there's a team called Rite of Passage. and they're on a Santa Cruz 27. And I know you don't know boats, but it's an old production boat that is a bit of a thoroughbred for both recreation, like cruising, as well as racing. You can really push them, and they're cheap. And this team, their average age across the four of them is 16 and three quarter year old. And they, of course, if they just came to me and said, I want to do this race, I'd be like, not a chance. I don't care what experience you have, but they are surrounded with a support network that they've assembled of training, of advice. They have a couple, they have the captain of the LC Piddock, which is the first boat that ever won the race, that Al Hughes, and he's one of their advisors. They've surrounded themselves with the team. They're doing medical training. I'm really excited about them because they're the new guard of adventure, right? For when we shuffle our mortal coil off or however it goes. And they're coming out to do the race, which is really fantastic. The one to leave the most parts on the water, I think, is going to be a team that is racing a prototype boat. They're testing it right now. That essentially looks like a TIE fighter, and not the old school TIE fighters, but like Kylo Ren's TIE fighter. They even called it Whisper, which was the name of his TIE fighter. My buddy Jesse, I think, maybe suggested that. But what's funny is the captain who's captaining that boat, or at least one of the crew, maybe he's not the captain, is that guy, Carl Kruger, who did the stand-up paddleboard. And it's a hydroplaning boat. So it sails fast enough. It'll go up on hydroplanes, no longer restricted by the hydrodynamics of water and displacement. And it's supposed to take off, I say, until the first of many logs start ripping the hydroplanes off the bottom of the boat. But they're coming out. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Oh, it's kind of funny. We're sitting here talking. I've got my other screen up, so I could maybe ask a question that sounds like I know what I'm talking about, which I don't. But I just got a message because I'd reached out to Team Oracle. So literally, as you were talking about them, they're like, yeah, well, we'd love to talk with you. So
you're kidding, really? Oh yeah. They are, don't tell them I said this, so don't let them listen to the podcast. They are such A-class people. It's humbling. It's amazing. Yeah.
Very cool. So when is the race this year?
Yeah, the race starts June 13th. And it starts in Port Townsend. Leading up to it is another adventure race we do called 7048, which is it's 70 miles, 48 hours, human powered only from Tacoma to Port Townsend. So it finishes. We have a big party that's free as well called the Ruckus. It's a block party right there. And then the next morning, Race to Alaska starts at 5 a.m.
Yeah. Is there a time limit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we can't sit up and catch can, of course. we employ what we call the Grim Sweeper. So 10 days after the race starts, a boat leaves Port Townsend and makes 75 miles a day up the course. And if it happens to pass you, you're out. You're just, it'll point you to the nearest marina, give you a clap on the back, and it's all you. That's it. Yeah.
So that could be like 20 days though.
23.
Roughly.
Yeah.
23 days.
So. Long time.
Yeah.
You should ask Team Oracle about that because they beat the Grim Sweeper by 1 hour into Ketchikan. They were the final team. They were paddling and beat them by 1 hour.
Yeah. See, I'll ask them that and they'll say, wow, you know what you're talking about. And little do they know what we know that I don't know shit about nothing.
You're doing great, man.
Well, I think we talked about it in the first podcast, how when I was in high school, I was actually a pretty good sailor for living in South Dakota, but
yeah,
that was like that many years ago.
A minute or so, two. Yeah.
I know what a mast is still.
Yeah, that's good.
The terminology. So, that's cool. trying to think of what's a good question to finish with, but you talk so much, you answer all my good questions.
I mean, I talk a lot.
You're the best kind of guest.
Well, I do want to make sure that everyone who might be listening this far into the podcast, God bless y'all, that it's one of the like the prime pillars of the race is access. One of the reasons we did this race was that we wanted people that were not like elite whatever to have an opportunity to do an elite level event. But we recognize that not everyone can get out on the water or make it to Alaska. And because of that, everything we do for those who want to watch is free. So we have free parties like the Ruckus. We have free gatherings up in Ketchikan and want everyone to come to the finish line. But we have the tracker where you can follow all the teams 24 hours a day. That's free and online. And we do a ton of social media, as well as we spend a lot of time doing write-ups on bios. And they're not your ordinary bio. I mean, it's all I can say about it. But if you go to r2ak.com, go to teams bios with a cup of coffee or something stronger, it will be worth the adventure.
Yeah, it's a fun read. Let's put it that way. Some of them.
Yeah, thank you. So, high praise. I'll take it.
Cool. Okay. Cool. All right. Awkward Zoom meeting. Bye.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, thanks, Randy. And yeah, if as you continue to like spelunk your way through the race, if you need any teams or anything, whatever, just give me a call.
Send me like some contact for some of the teams you think would be good to talk to, if you could.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I'll hit them up. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Hope you feel better.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And good luck with the anniversary. Enjoy the pie.
I'm going to. All right. Thanks.
All right. Take it easy.
Bye.
down. Jerry was a race car driver, 22 years old. One too many bars, one night rep, self-right round, telephone bar.